I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about creating places, the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority's statewide placemaking initiative. We'll discuss what placemaking is and what the hopes for it are. My guests are Carmen Lethig, Placemaking Manager, Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, Joanna Taft, Executive Director of the Harrison Center, and Veronica Watson, Director of Indiana Operations, Patronicity. Please join the conversation by calling 866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, finding us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or tracking us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about creating places. It's the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority's statewide placemaking initiative. It's now in its second year. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Carmen Lethig. She is Placemaking Manager for the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. Joanna Taft. She is Executive Director of the Harrison Center. And joining us by phone is Veronica Watson, Director of Indiana Operations for Patronicity. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's good to have you all here. And I should point out that because radio is not a visual medium, that creating places, the little logo has the IN in capital letters to emphasize the Indiana aspect. That's not something you catch in the pronunciation unless I really, really mangle it. I'm going to start with you, Carmen. Talk to me a little bit about what placemaking is.
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me on the show
today.
So I've done a lot of presentations over the past couple of years about placemaking and what it is. And thankfully, now it's getting to be more of a mainstream term. But so one of the ways that I like to talk to my audience and ask them about what they think placemaking is, or to get them into the idea of what a place is to have them close their eyes. And I won't do that since we're on the radio, but I ask them to imagine their favorite place. And it can be any place, you know, your backyard, your favorite vacation spot, bookstore, whatever. And to think about the elements of why they love that place. Okay, so how does it make you feel? What is there to do there? Who is there? What's going on? What does it smell like? Do you feel safe? All the different senses are evoked of why you love that place. So the sense of emotion, that taking that and making that the concrete is what placemaking is. So doing that, making those same feelings in places in our communities is one way to describe it. A better, more concrete way to talk about it is that it's really kind of a relatively new term for an old common sense idea that those of us that have been working in urban planning and community development and place-based arts and all those, real estate development, all those different disciplines that make up actually making places that we can walk around in and making taking those ideas and making them creating places that are built for people and places and not around things like cars or separate uses. So putting all of those elements together to create places where people want to live, work, and play.
Veronica, why is this this movement gaining momentum now?
In terms of placemaking, do you mean?
Yeah.
I think that there's a growing awareness that these are the types of places that we want to live long term, not just when we're at a certain age, but, you know, young, old. We are looking for the kind of places that maybe our grandparents or great grandparents grew up where they could walk to certain places. They didn't have to spend all day in a car to get to three different locations. It just seems to be that there's been that raising of awareness across lots of different industries, not just in city planning, but I know in health and others are kind of keeping an eye on this idea that we should be making our communities around people and not around cars.
How do we go about doing that? I'll stay with you, Veronica.
I think there are a number of things that we could be doing. Part of it does need to happen at City Hall in terms of, you know, the fun concepts like zoning and whatnot. But in terms of the maybe grassroots and neighborhood levels, there are some things that people can be doing to fight for their neighborhoods to either maybe stay places where people can live, work, and play, or maybe remaking them into those types of cities, such as, you know, using a funding program like Creating Places or connecting with other organizations to, you know, take advantage of other resources or even just connecting with neighbors and talking about what everyone wants to see in their community, again, either as something new or to keep it as it has been. You know, there are lots of different steps depending on, you know, where people are coming from and how involved they want to be.
Joanna, how important are these, is this placemaking movement to communities and to creating that sense of community?
I think it's very powerful, and it's simple. It's something that everybody can do. A neighbor can join into placemaking. A nonprofit, a business can partner. To be able to celebrate place and to elevate these things about neighborhoods that we long for helps people connect and helps people participate in their neighborhood. It's easy to do. It's lighter, quicker, faster. They call it creative placemaking because the part that I join in, because you can do a lot with a little bit of money.
And that sort of teases up. If you are just joining us, we are talking about Creating Places, which is a new statewide placemaking initiative of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So I'm going to throw this out. I'll start with Veronica, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts on this. You know, in an ideal world, and I know practical, how is this supposed to work? How are we supposed to go about creating these places that we desire? I'll start with Veronica on that.
I think to start with, as Joanna was mentioning, you know, finding partners, whether that is your neighbors going to maybe a neighborhood meeting, or coming to some other community meeting that involves local businesses and working together first to identify what would make your neighborhood that place that you are desiring, what elements are you missing, what elements do you want to preserve. You know, coming up with that kind of plan or that vision is definitely the first place to start, and making sure that it's built on the assets that the community already has. I think one of the issues that we can sometimes come across when talking about placemaking and encouraging it is that a lot of communities will look at what other neighborhoods are doing and they say, that looks good, I want that, without maybe taking into consideration that, you know, maybe that kind of park doesn't fit within their neighborhood, or maybe they don't need that specific type, you know, that specific element that works so well. They are taking into account their own history, what is already there, and building on that so that they can be a unique place and a place that fits well within the context of their community.
I'll go next to Carmen.
Yeah, so I come from more of a traditional background in urban planning. And so when I talk about placemaking to communities throughout the state of Indiana, I talk about that there are actually four different kinds of placemaking. And there's standard and strategic, creative, and tactical, which is sort of that lighter, quicker, cheaper that Joanna mentioned earlier. So it's really about taking some of the traditional ways of planning and looking at community revitalization and thinking about where the community or the town or the neighborhood or whatever it is, where they are today. So looking around and saying, okay, here's where we're at. Now, where do we want to be? and really using the place and the people in that place to try to get to those goals. And which type of placemaking you use to get there really depends on where you are and where you want to be in the future.
What, Joanna, what are the elements that that appeal to the creative spirit about this?
I think it's pretty amazing to know that an artist or a creative can actually solve community problems. Mm-hmm. And so in the neighborhood work that we've done, we've worked with neighbors to identify a challenge in the neighborhood that the arts can solve. So one of the things that we've been working on a lot recently are neighborhoods that are afraid of gentrification, and they're afraid of being that people are going to be pushed out. And so the arts has been able to help build a more inclusive neighborhood and help help people develop empathy to understand that you're not entering into a neighborhood with a blank slate. You're entering into a neighborhood with a story, and it's important to elevate that story and elevate the long-term residents and to for them to be known as key to that neighborhood. So I think that the creatives, they're not just in their studio creating a piece of art that's going to hang on a museum wall. They can take some of those same skills and they can actually heal neighborhoods.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about creating places. It's a new statewide placemaking initiative. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Or you can do what a listener named Owen has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Owen, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, John. Thanks. I just had a quick question in regards to, you know, how do we ensure placemaking doesn't ostracize some people in the community, and how do we ensure that it doesn't drive people out of communities that they've been in for you know, many decades now?
That's the, in some ways, the gentrification question that we were talking about. I'll throw that one to Veronica first. Thank you for the call, Owen.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that that's a question that we all are wrestling with and should definitely continue to wrestle with. I think one of the things that need to be kept in mind from the beginning in terms of any type of placemaking, planning, or implementation is making sure that residents are given the opportunity to engage, whether that's just voicing their opinion or maybe taking part in planning and implementation, that you're giving them lots of different outlets to be involved. You're not just holding a monthly town hall meeting at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday, that you are giving people a chance to have their say, get involved at different times of the week, either in meetings, maybe taking part in different activities. But just making sure they have a chance to be involved is definitely one of the first things that needs to be planned for when it comes to placemaking.
Carmen, you're looking like you want to add something.
Well, so this is one of the things I talk about in our presentations a lot, too, is the way that you can really use placemaking to, again, build off some of those traditional planning techniques, such as getting community input. And so I come from a world of federal funding, and so we're always used to having having our recipients get public input. And the way that you can use tactics in placemaking to really engage the community at all different kinds of levels. So you can have those meetings, you know, where people come and put their input and really talk about what they want to see. And you need to, if you are doing these projects on the ground level, you need to take that traditional way, but also kind of flip it on its side and think about how to use other groups in the community, such as artists, right? And think about simple, easy ways that you can get community input at the community's leisure. So, you know, we talk about you know, making chalkboard signs, for example, to have up in the community and say, here's an empty space, what would you like to see? And so someone can come and write their ideas at any time that they want. They can feel comfortable doing it. And, you know, someone comes and takes a picture of that input later on. So, you know, hopefully that input is actually being used, and the people doing these projects, whether they're non-for-profits or at the local unit of government level, are constantly going back and thinking of ways to change the project based on that community input, testing things out with that tactical urbanism that is a lighter, quicker, cheaper, doesn't cost a lot of money, non-permanent, get people involved, and do what works well and what doesn't.
We are talking about creating places on No Limits today. That is the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority's statewide placemaking initiative. It's now in its second year. My guests are Carmen Lethig. She is placemaking manager for the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. Joanna Taft, who is executive director of the Harrison Center. And joining us by phone is Veronica Watson, who is director of Indiana Operations for Patronicity. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about creating places, that is the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority's statewide placemaking initiative. My guests are Carmen Lethig. She is placemaking manager of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. Joanna Taft, executive director of the Harrison Center, and joining us by phone is Veronica Watson, who's director of Indiana Operations for Patronicity. So now that we've talked in general terms about what placemaking is, probably ought to talk about what this program is and how it works, and the role that each of these organizations has in it. I'll start with Carmen on that one.
Okay, sure. So when we created my position at IHCDA, I thought a lot about what placemaking is and what it means for the state of Indiana. And doing some research, we came across this, the creating places equivalent in Michigan, and just while we were doing general research. And so we looked into it a little more and thought this is a great program that really truly engages the community at the community level, at the ground level, which we don't get to do a lot at working, at the state level. And it's a great way to promote placemaking in a very tangible sense by activating public spaces, underutilized public spaces. So we did some vetting and finally got approval from our board of directors in late 2016. And we got funded for $1 million, and we were able to get another allocation this year in order to fund various kinds of projects that, again, activate public spaces. And that can range anywhere from farmers markets to art installations, to tours, to playground equipment, to a variety of things that basically help engage the public in enjoying the public spaces, because our public spaces are very important in helping community members feel a part and connected to the place.
Veronica, talk to me about how your organization plugs into this.
Yeah, so Patronicity is a civic crowdfunding and crowd granting online platform. We function pretty similar to other crowdfunding websites like GoFundMe or Kickstarter, but we focus very specifically on community-based projects, specifically in public spaces. So our role is basically to help manage with the day-to-day of this program and the programs that we run in other states, focusing on the crowdfunding aspect. We've been doing this work for several years now, so when projects are applying to receive funding from IHCDA, once they are approved to participate in the program, they have to run a crowdfunding campaign so that they are raising somewhere between $5,000 and $50,000. Because crowdfunding is still a relatively new concept, especially when you get outside of urban areas, part of my role and what we at Patronicity do is to provide technical assistance to projects that are applying and participating in the program so that they have the support that they need in order to successfully meet their financial goals and be awarded a matching grant from IHCDA.
When you say you provide technical assistance, could you give me a concrete example of that for people who are not familiar with the world of crowdfunding?
Yeah, so if someone hears about this program, you know, maybe through this radio show or possibly from a friend or colleague, I think that's usually where we get applicants or people just kind of hearing about it, but they don't know that much about the program, Patronicity, IHCDA, or even crowdfunding. All they know is that they've been told to check out this funding program because they want to build a pocket park in their downtown. They can either go to our website or email me directly, which is what they eventually do or what we hope they do, and start a conversation with me, usually over the phone at some point, to talk them through what is this program, what's eligible, how does it work, and then where they can describe a little bit more about what they're hoping to do so that I can basically tell them, do I think they are eligible for this program? And if so, here are the steps they should take in order to apply. Here are the steps that they should be taking to plan for their campaign. And then even after that, if they do apply and they're accepted by IHCDA, it gives final approval on all projects, continue to provide that support so that as they are planning to fundraise or crowdfund, which they have to do within 30 to 60 days, it's a pretty short time period. Part of my support that I can provide is helping them plan through what can they do in order to raise that funding, which is going to look very different depending on the community. Sometimes it's through social media and email. Sometimes it's through flyers and local events. Usually it's a mix of all of those plus whatever else works well in that community. I basically am there to handhold through the program as much or as little as each individual project needs.
What are the most common mistakes or misconceptions people have about these crowdfunding efforts?
The biggest one that we run into, especially I think when this program first started, I believe now that's been around and those that are applying are somewhat familiar with it, they understand it better. But in terms of crowdfunding in general, one of the biggest misconceptions we run into is that you can set up a nice page, you can throw up a couple of pictures, you know, describe your project, publish it, put out a couple of links on Facebook and Twitter, and magically you'll raise $10,000. That very rarely happens that way. It's not impossible. We have seen that in some projects, but it really does take a lot more outreach. It takes a lot more effort from project teams in order to, one, let people know that your campaign is happening. Not everyone is on social media. And then making sure that people understand, why is this important? You know, hopefully the project is something that has been discussed in the community already. So when people see it, they'll connect with it automatically. They'll get excited. But if not, if they weren't aware of those discussions already, or maybe this is a somewhat newer idea, letting people know about it, why it's important, and why it's important that they donate for it, that can take a lot more time and effort than I think many people realize before they are familiar with crowdfunding.
And I know, Veronica, you have to leave us here very, very shortly. You'd mentioned that if people want to reach out to you, do you feel comfortable giving contact information for yourself or for Patronicity over the air here and letting people know how to reach out if they do have questions about how to participate?
Yeah, so I'll give my email. It's Veronica, V-E-R-O-N-I-C-A, @ patronicity.com. That's patronicity.com. They can always reach me by email there. Phone can somewhat be a little bit more difficult. So definitely email, or if they just go to our website, patronicity.com, there is usually a button at the lower left-hand corner where people can leave a comment or ask a question, and that will get back to me as well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Certainly. So, Joanna, what is the incentive or the motivation for an organization such as the Harrison Center to take part in this campaign?
So we're always looking for the resources that we need to do the work in the community. And so this new resource has just been amazing. Not only do they help you raise money, you have to raise the money, mm-hmm. you know, they help you. I mean, Veronica would send me weekly emails and she would watch our Facebook and say, you know, Joanna, you guys haven't been talking about it as much this week. And you know, she would gently and firmly suggest things that we could be doing to be successful. And I would tell you that we would not have been successful. We've done two campaigns and we would not have been without that technical assistance that Patronicity has provided.
What were the two campaigns for?
The first one was Pre-Enact Indy. And I think you know a little
yes,
bit about that.
Yeah. And we did a show on that. Yes,
that's
that
right.
One I know.
And then the second one is Lift Indy, and that's picking up where Pre-Enact Indy left off. Just a week after Pre-Enact Indy, the city chose that neighborhood as a Lift Indy neighborhood, and they're investing $4.5 million into that neighborhood for inclusive development. And so you cannot do inclusive development without the arts is our position. And so we are the creative placemaking partner, and the city encouraged us to apply for these funds. And again, we would not have been successful without the technical assistance.
We are talking about Creating Places. That is the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority's statewide placemaking initiative. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what Courtney has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Courtney, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I appreciate you guys covering this topic, one. But two, a big question I have is, you know, talking about placemaking. But I would like to hear more from the actual community leaders who are from these neighborhoods on their perspective on this. So one, I kind of would have liked to heard that, I think, during this program, but also I'm just curious if you can kind of give some names. I'm sure they've got Twitter feeds or, you know, Instagram, Facebook, whatever, of the people who are actually from these neighborhoods or the community leaders that we can, like, tap into so we can listen to them and kind of hear their thoughts on all of this.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. And that sounds like one for Carmen.
Sure. So one of the things that I think probably the best thing to do at this point would be to go to the Patronicity website that Veronica mentioned right before she signed off. And if you go up to the top of the screen, there is actually a drop-down menu that says programs, and our program is listed on there. And if you click on it, you'll be able to look at every single project that's been funded through this program. And there should be some contact information for the leader of that project, so the partners that were involved. And if not, Veronica or I are welcome to connect you to those projects. I will say that I think this program has probably been the most rewarding thing that I've done in my career so far, because everybody who has been involved in it has really truly believed in the project that they're doing and in their community. So I've got to be able to meet some wonderful people throughout the state that are just doing really creative things for the places that they love. And I'd love to be able to connect you to them, and they would for sure talk to you in detail about what they did. And if you want to do anything like that yourself in your neighborhood, they could help you do that. And so can Veronica and I.
We've got a comment that's on a similar theme via Twitter from a listener named Mandla. And if you would like to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Mandla writes, "Glad to hear the Great Places conversation to include older adults. I want to talk a bit about what is the vetting process on this. How do you deal with the idea if there are multiple ideas for the same space, you know, differing perceptions, and how do you, you know, at some level determine what is realistic or feasible? I mean, I love Indiana, but the way you, at least originally you framed this, Carmen, if you think of your favorite place, but the only thing I can think of that would make Indiana better would be to have an ocean or a mountain somewhere close by, and I'm not sure that's within your powers. So,
Well, I wish it was within my power, but that is one of the things that that we talk about a lot. Is that, you know, one of the reasons why talking about placemaking and doing these kind of programs is important is because we need people to stay in Indiana. We need people to move to Indiana, and we don't have a lot of those assets that people are moving to places like California, such as the weather or the beaches or mountains or whatever. So we need to be able to create those places and all the communities of all sizes in Indiana that really entice people to want to visit or live or, you know, make jobs in those communities. So as far as the vetting process goes, we really leave that up to the local community. So we, besides going out and doing presentations and talking to mayors at like a high level about what is placemaking, what is creating places, just like this conversation we're having today, we don't actively go out and say, you know, you should do something at this public space. So we kind of are letting the communities be the leaders, which they should be, right? Because every community is unique and they know what is best for their community. And just to kind of circle back to what we were talking about earlier in the program is that we really want creating places to be an extension of ideas and conversations and needs and desires that are already happening in that community. So we're really a vehicle to help get to the outcome and basically just to be a partner in making an idea a reality in that public space.
Joanna, same question, but from the other side. How do you decide, and with your organization, which of these initiatives you want to get on board with?
I think it's where we've been invited. So a creative placemaking project that we've been working on before Patronicity was with Maple Crossing, one of the great places that your caller referred to. And we were invited by the neighbors to be the provide technical assistance, to be the creating placemaking partner. And so they had goals, and our job was to help them achieve their goals. And elevating the stories of the long-term residents was one of those that we really enjoyed. So so we look at who invited us and do we have the resources, the technical assistance to help them for their community challenge.
What sort of programs or initiatives would you say no to? Tougher question, I know.
Well, it's interesting. When we first started doing creative placemaking, we were all about vitality. I wouldn't say that I wouldn't do vitality again, but my real heart with creative placemaking is equity and elevating the stories of place and the long-term residents. And so the Harrison Center right now, that is our focus in creative placemaking. When we're partnering with the neighborhood, we are celebrating that neighborhood story. We're celebrating the long-term residents. We're celebrating the long-term businesses. And we want the new residents that may move in to not think of the neighborhood as a blank slate, but to be thinking of entering into an existing story. So that is really where how we're judging our creative placemaking right now.
What are the benefits for you as an organization for doing this? I mean, I can see the benefits for the community. How does it help the Harrison Center?
I think that, so if you know the Harrison Center, we started high school, right? Mm-hmm. We have traditionally have taken the arts and used the strength of the arts to solve a community problem. And so this is not new. Creative placemaking is not new for us. This is a new term. But we have always looked into the community, seen a need, and come up with a distinctly cultural solution. So it's the work that we do. We have our creative resources that can solve community problems. And it's very exciting to actually see the work that we've done.
What are the challenges, though, that come with it? What's the hardest part about doing this work?
Well, it's all very hard.
Yeah.
I think that if you don't, we do a good job of being invited into a neighborhood, but if you're not invited into a neighborhood and you go in, I think that would be pretty hard because you're not necessarily wanted or accepted. So I think that we try to make it as easy for ourselves as possible to have the right partnerships and to have a partnership that makes sense for the community and pair the right artists with the right business. For instance, up in Maple Crossing, we did we brought in a hip hop gospel artist from Baltimore, and he wrote a song. He hung out at the Cheatham and Moore Barbershop, and he wrote a song called "The Barbershop of Blessings." And we did a video with the barbers dancing in it, and that has had 50,000 views on Facebook. And the neighbors have just celebrated that, the way we've elevated that story.
We are talking about creating places. It's a new statewide placemaking initiative from the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority. My guests are Carmen Lethig, she's placemaking manager for the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, and Joanna Taft, who is executive director of the Harrison Center. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about creating places. That's the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority's statewide placemaking initiative. It's now in its second year. And I should point out again, because radio is not a visual medium, that the IN in creating is uppercase to reference Indiana. My guests are Carmen Lethig, who is placemaking manager for the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, and Joanna Taft, who is executive director of the Harrison Center. We were joined earlier by Veronica Watson, who is director of Indiana Operations for Patronicity. So, Carmen, walk me through this. If someone says, some residents of a place decide, oh, okay, we've got an idea for this, how do they go about that? What kind of resources specifically are available for them? Just walk me through the process of how they can bring their idea to you and get it considered.
Sure. We pride ourselves at this program as one of our most flexible programs that we have. So we have a very short policy, so 5 pages of, what you can and can't do. But we do have 2 eligible applicants, and those are local units of government and non-for-profit organizations. The great thing about this program, though, as we've talked about almost this entire program, is that people are at the center of it. So we encourage that if an individual citizen does have an idea, and we have had a project like that, that they, go to their local government or they go to their local non-for-profit that works on community development or creative placemaking or whatever it is, and talk to someone about the idea. Get partnerships and get people involved. And then from there, it's really working to see, are there other ideas for that space? Are there plans for that space at the, local government or the non-for-profit like we talked about? And so once the idea is fully developed and that there is, buy-in at the local level, then they would approach Patronicity or myself in how to engage the program and how to get funding to make that an idea, a reality.
We probably ought to talk about what qualifies as a public place. It sounds like this is obviously not an idea for someone who says, oh, gee, putting a hot tub in my backyard would make it my favorite place.
Yes,
That is not an idea that will be looked upon with favor.
Sure. Well, we don't have a set, we don't make anyone give us documentation to, fully verify the ownership of the place. But I guess that's not really true. In a way, we do, because we do need to make sure that it's a public space and that the entity who owns the property is allowing an activity to take place on it. So, for example, traditional public spaces are places, the easiest ones to identify are parks or plazas. But things like sidewalks and streets and libraries and other civic buildings are also public spaces. But we have also made eligible certain public spaces. It may not be open to the public 100% of the time. For example, YMCA has a project, I think they have a project live right now. That's a membership-based entity. But what we do is work with them on a one-on-one basis and say, you could be eligible as long as you make this project open to the public for a reasonable amount of time each week or each month or whatever, so that it really truly can be enjoyed by the public as a whole. So all that to say is we really try to be as open-minded as we can with the people who have ideas and to work with them to make their projects eligible within the constraints of that this is a state funding source and we have to be cognizant of that.
And it doesn't have to. It sounds like since pre-enactment was one of these relatively early, it sounds like, endeavors, it doesn't have to be a permanent transformation. It can be an event that adds to the civic life. Talk to us a little bit. I know for those listeners who really care, there is we did an hour-long show on pre-enactment.
Yeah.
But if you could encapsulate that, Joanna, talk a little bit about what it was and how it turned out and how you got involved with this movement through it.
Sure. So people have heard of reenactment. Maybe they've been to Connor Prairie. So pre-enactment is acting out a world that ought to be. And we partnered with, and that would be a world of justice and equity. We partnered with 12 theater companies, and the set designers built temporary buildings on the vacant lots. And so that was placemaking, building those pieces of those buildings and that public art. And then the actors acted out a script that was all based on 2 years of interviews that we'd done in the neighborhood, what the neighbors' hopes and dreams were for the neighborhood. And so we included every sidewalk and every street, so it was very much a public space. Those three blocks, that three-block performance was very much a public space that people could participate in. But it wasn't really just a one-day event, and that's where people get confused about pre-enactment. It was really, we worked on this for about 2 years, so there was a lot of community building that happened.
But the payoff was all in that one day. A very stressful one day, I would imagine.
That's right. So we had this idea, but we had received $75,000 from the NEA, and we did not know how we were going to get the match that was required for the NEA. And I heard from a coworker about this program, and so I called Veronica, and it seemed to be a really good fit. And so we were able to fix our gap and really be able to do an amazing program.
So let me ask this then, Carmen, if we're talking about these spaces and all of that, like Joanna makes mention of the fact that, vacant or abandoned lots, they put up temporary structures on. Is there a way for neighbors to get together if there is a vacant lot or a building that has been abandoned there, even if it's a private house, and come and say, as far as we can tell, no one owns this, no one cares for it. This is what we'd like to do with this space to make this neighborhood better. Would that qualify?
It's it's possible. So I think what we would have to do is just make sure that if whatever the site was, if it wasn't in ownership by the people who want to do the project implementation, that they have permission to do the project.
So there can't be so if the owners come to you and say, we'd like to surrender this to be public space, that would be okay?
Potentially, yeah. And we don't get too much into the long-term ownership or maintenance of, Veronica does vet a lot of that up front as far as, are you going to be able to maintain whatever it is? Who's going to own it? But as far as in comparison to some of the other programs that I've worked on at IHCDA, we don't look at this in the very, very super long term. But we do want to make sure that we are being good stewards of the funding that we have available. So we want to make sure that everything is done on the up and up and everything is legal and will be able to happen if they go through the campaign. Because at the end of the campaign, we don't want, people are donating their money and they're spending their time and, they're getting their hopes up for something, a community vision, right? So we don't want it to fall flat if we weren't doing all of our vetting on the front end.
How much money is available for people who want to do these projects?
So for each individual project, we have $5,000 to $50,000 is what can be matched to whatever the crowd funding raise is. So if they're raising $5,000 and they do that and they're successful, we will match it $5,000. We just got allocated another $1 million back in August, and we have just under $1 million to continue this program at least for another year or whenever the funding runs out.
That sounds like a lot of money, Joanna, but I'm guessing like even with pre-enactment, where you're talking about covering three blocks and having, a cast of 50, 100, whatever, and all those theater companies, you can burn through the money in a hurry.
Sure, yeah. And the limit is $50,000 for their project.
Yeah. So how pre-enactment, how what was the price tag on that? Finally,
well, so there's the part that they covered, which was if you want the number that started 2 years before, mm-hmm. you know, it's really a $250,000 project. I think it was about $200,000 with that focus year period of time. Yeah.
What are the more modest ideas that meet approval, Carmen?
So I don't know what I think the least amount that we've fundraised for was $7,500, and that was for a preservation tour in Gary. So much like Joanna's project, it was not a permanent structure that was left. It was an event to get people to think about the history of Gary, to think about the future of Gary, to get people downtown in Gary and walking around and realizing the space in a different way than maybe they had imagined Gary to be. I think that's the least amount of funds that we've done.
Okay. And the program includes all of the state of Indiana, right?
Yes. Correct. Every community in Indiana is eligible.
Okay. And what is the minimum threshold for being considered? I mean, is there...
So we don't have a threshold other than you need to make sure you're one of the eligible entities, like I said, a local unit of government or a non-for-profit. We do want to make sure that, like I said, that we are the entity has ownership of the space or has permission to use the space. We do look at the budget items as far as making sure that there is the ability for an entity to actually have time to work on the campaign, and because that's a lot of work, and to actually make the campaign come to fruition within that year time period. So once a campaign has raised their funds and they receive all the money from IHCDA and Patronicity, they have 1 year to implement. And so they need to be able to take pictures and then do things like this for us if we ask them to come talk about the program and their experiences with it. And just really as far as the project itself, is it activating an underutilized or vacant public space? Is it really getting to the heart of what we're talking about when we talk about public spaces being connecting to that place and connecting to the people in that place? So the place needs to be pretty walkable and needs to be able to show that, like, I'm not going to probably approve a project that is a park, for example, in the middle of a cornfield. To me, that's not activating a public space, right?
Not to mention it might irritate the owner of the cornfield.
You know what I mean.
Yeah.
We're looking at is it going to be an activated space that also complements other things that are happening in the area and vice versa.
Gotten a listener joining in via Twitter, and again, if you want to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Listener writes, any good ideas around using creative placemaking to fight food deserts? Joanna, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. I think that you can raise awareness to both the neighbors and the powers that be. And so you can do that through art and through connecting people and having these discussions, but then also in solving it, you know, you could do a pop-up grocery store. We actually had a couple years ago, we did a pop-up vegan kind of grocery. It was kind of a giveaway, but there are ways that you can do pop-ups that kind of give people the idea of, oh, there could be a grocery store here. Oh, this is what it would look like if there's a grocery store here. And when people can see it and try it on, they're much more likely to know what they're working toward. So I think that creative placement can help people envision what it would look like to have a grocery store in their community.
Carmen, that raises another avenue of questions. I mean, in addition to just enhancing the life of communities, beautifying them or adding to the culture, are there ways to use this to combat pressing social challenges? Food deserts would be one, but say in areas where there's violent crime or other persistent challenges, are there ways to do that? And would the Housing and Community Development Authority look with favor upon those.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the great things about this program is that, again, we try to make it fit for whatever the community need is. So food deserts are a good example. We've had two projects that actually do address that, one in Bedford and one campaign that's actually live right now here in Indianapolis, where they actually implemented, you know, or will implement mm-hmm. a community garden, but also to take the discussion to a higher level as to what does it mean to be a food desert and, you know, mixing educational and health aspects into those projects. So it's not just going to pick a piece of food at a community garden. But then, you know, there are other ways that I think that this program can help address larger social issues. I think some of the couple projects like Anderson's, they did a town art center where it's a space for thinking about arts and innovation. And so out of innovation, you know, maybe we will have someone who comes up with an idea on how to help create jobs in the community, to help educate people in the community, to get to those topics like education and the need for better paying jobs or paying jobs at all. So we definitely, some of my favorite projects are projects that are able to address, you know, more than one community need. And I would really love to be able to see more of those projects come to us for partnering in their community.
What project that you have seen so far is the one that was the most outside the box?
I don't know how outside of the box this is, but I really love it. There was a trolley project in Evansville. So, and I don't know all the details of all the projects because that's sort of Veronica's role in the program.
Yeah.
But it's my understanding that there was a trolley in Evansville, or there is, and they wanted to expand it to a certain neighborhood. And so I think that I like that project because it really, you know, we would never be able to fund anything that has to do with transportation in our agency if it wasn't for this project. And it gets to other, you know, connecting people to other neighborhoods and to other businesses and getting people out of their cars. I also really loved the Warsaw Alley project, which I think alleys are becoming more commonplace, but it's just a beautiful project that was very well executed and has been really successful. I joke because mostly projects don't turn out to look like their drawings, but this looked, excuse me, exactly like it. And I think it will help with some of their retention of interns and people who are coming to work there in the orthopedics industry. So it has a dual purpose.
Well, and that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Carmen Lethig of the Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, and Joanna Taft of the Harrison Center, as well as Veronica Watson of Patronicity, for a lively and fascinating conversation about placemaking. We will be back next Tuesday when we're going to talk about the year in movies with our film crew. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.